Hello, folks. We come to you today from the Young Street Lecture Auditorium in London for a colloquium on the Donald Trump administration. I'm Michael L. Roberts. This is the American Chronicle. Delighted to say I'm backstage here at the conference with Dr. James D. Boies, who's put all of this together today. James, tell us all about it.
So we've organised a one-day panel referring to the Trump administration. We've called it Reflections and Projections, the Trump Administration and U.S. Grand Strategy. And the attempt here is to try to examine, through a variety of talks, various elements of the Trump administration, both reflecting upon the election which has been and gone, and trying to get some idea about a potential Trump administration and what it means for the world, both thinking about its implications in terms of policy, personalities, as well as its relationship with Great Britain, especially in light of Brexit. And of course, we meet today, January 27th, 2017, just as Theresa May becomes the first foreign leader to meet Donald Trump in the White House. So it's quite an auspicious day.
Let's listen now then to Dr. Boies' conference contribution. How did we get to where we are?
On the basis that today's talk is being referred to as Reflections and Projections, I thought that as my esteemed colleagues are talking very much about projections, I would try and offer some degree of reflection to try and understand how it is that we got to where we are. How did we arrive at what many people thought of as being an alternate reality? Certainly when I got asked to put this event together today, which I was very, very happy to do. I think most people expected that a talk on US grand strategy and foreign policy at this time and this place would focus very much upon Hillary Clinton's administration and talking about who was going to be serving in that cabinet, how wrong we all would have been. Don't worry about it, only I think me in this whole room, and maybe Brian, I don't know, was stupid enough to go on national television and tell anybody that don't worry about it, folks, she's got this. I will never learn. I do think that the hottest places in hell, quite frankly, are reserved for those who are expected to offer punditry and then sit on the fence. Quite frankly, the amount of people I've met subsequently in interview rooms and green rooms who sit there in from various think tanks, which will go nameless, but if I mention Chatham House, forgive me, telling me how they knew this was going to happen but couldn't possibly say as much. And I'm thinking, well, you're getting paid to come up with these ideas. For God's sake, have the strength of your convictions to say so, one way or the other, even if you're wrong. So, quite frankly, even though I proved not to be 100% accurate with my predictions, I still stand by the calculations upon which I arrived at them. What were they and why did that happen? Why did so many of us get this so fundamentally and utterly 100% wrong? There were, I think, several reasons to suspect that Hillary Clinton was going to win this, even though it would have been a historic anomaly for certain reasons. What were they? First of all, I think there's this idea of looking at demographic shifts within the United States. If you look back over a series of presidential elections, it seemed, and indeed it was stated in many places, that the United States was growing to a point where the Republican Party at a presidential level was potentially going to become irrelevant. It was said many times that there were not enough uneducated white men left to elect a Republican president. And in many ways, that appeared to be true. If you looked at the voting blocks, who was voting for who, in which elections and where across the country, it appeared, without doubt, quite frankly, that the Republican electoral base was getting whiter and older, and that that was a one-way trip to oblivion. And that, it seemed, coupled with the idea of what was being referred to as the Obama coalition, appeared to indicate that Hillary Clinton's election was all but guaranteed. Surely, 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 the coalition that had elected Barack Obama for two successive terms to office would hold. Surely that progressive era, effectively, if we can think of it in such terms, would hold together to elect America's first female president to the presidency of the United States. That seemed to be pretty much a given. When you thought about how close in many ways she had been, especially when you consider towards the back end of that campaign, the extent to which Barack Obama campaigned personally for Hillary Clinton, said at one point in particular that he would take it as a personal insult if she was not elected and his supporters were to vote for Donald Trump. It seemed categorically undeniable that she was going to basically bring that on her. However, hanging over all this was this spectre, which is that if you look at cycles of American history, the American people have a funny tradition of basically ignoring whatever it is, and John talked about this idea of academic intellectualism and analysis, and basically following a pretty straightforward pattern, which is that with relatively few exceptions in the post-World War II era onwards, Americans have a nice habit of saying, right, you know what, we're going to give you guys two terms in office, and then you guys two terms in office. Republicans, Democrats. Two terms for each party, with relatively only two exceptions. The only exceptions being when George H.W. Bush gets a third term of the Republican Party in 1988, and when Jimmy Carter loses his bid for re-election in 1980. So this idea that perhaps, irrespective of what are Hillary Clinton's assets or liabilities, whatever one might have thought about Donald Trump, seemed to indicate that perhaps whoever the Republican Party nominee was going to be, it was going to lead to a Republican Party presidency in 2017 and from January of this year. There was also the challenge of how irregularly in American history anybody, any party, gets the shot at a third term in office. You know, we here in Europe, I think, all too often view the US through a European prism on the assumption that the route to office, and Hillary Clinton, I think, exemplifies this, is through hard work and through progressive office holding. I'm sure some of you saw the Saturday Night Live sketches in which Hillary Clinton kept trying to parade her resume out. It's like, yes, 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 yes. And you saw this particularly in the last stages of the campaign during the debate cycle, constantly trotting out her resume, talking about how experienced she was, holding that in complete juxtaposition to Donald Trump's lack of preparedness, quite clearly. And yet, throughout American history, time and time again, we see that the most qualified candidate on paper is not the candidate who wins the election. 2000 would be a classic example with Al Gore, for example. So the idea that it's very, very rare in American politics for any one party to hold on to power after a two-term presidency. George H.W. Bush, by the way, is an exception, and he was the first vice president to assume office in that manner for over 100 years. So this idea of doing what Hillary was trying to do was historically problematic. She was also seeking to become, I don't know if it ever came out of the campaign, only the first Secretary of State to become president since James Buchanan. That's before the Civil War. So this idea that she was facing an uphill battle in terms of a pattern in American politics is something which I think very few people realise or gave enough credit to in their analysis. What I'd like to do is to consider a few myths, however, about this election, which I think we need to address before they fester into fact. Let's get this big one out of the way first, which is the parallel between Brexit and Donald Trump's rise to the presidency. In my opinion, shorthand, simplistic, and the media love it, but I just don't buy it. Why? Whatever one thinks of the way that Brexit result went, and I'm sure there is a strong propensity against the result, and I still think that in a few years' time, the people who voted for it will be the most disappointed by the way it's implemented. Whatever one thinks about that result, what is undeniable is that there was a huge spike in turnout, and it resulted in a result which many, many people disagreed with, no doubt about it. What you don't see in the United States is anything paralleling that with regard to the huge spike in support for Donald Trump. I'm going to talk a little bit about turnout later on. But this idea that Donald Trump talks about himself, he is perpetuating this myth on a regular basis, this idea that he's talking about this groundswell of support, unprecedented, never before seen. It's simply not true. Just to give you a quick heads up, what you see in the 2016 election is not a huge spike in support for the Democratic, for the Republican Party, but a decline in support for the Democratic Party under Hillary Clinton. And that is fundamentally what gives rise to Donald Trump's presence. No sense of a Brexit parallel, in my opinion. Secondly, we're hearing Donald Trump in a bizarre fashion, and I certainly don't want to walk upon Brian's toes here, but I think we can hear more about this potentially later on. If you want to talk about electoral fraud, we've got the right person in the room to talk about it. This idea that Donald Trump is in some respect undermining his own authority as president by talking about the fact that he believes there has been massive voter fraud, which is what led to him losing the popular vote by some 3 million. This is remarkable because what Donald Trump is effectively saying is that the Democrats were smart enough to basically get 3 million people to vote for them who shouldn't, but they couldn't figure out how to get about another 700,000 to do so in the three key states that would have actually mattered. Third, this myth of Hillary Clinton's likability or not as being an impediment upon her candidacy for high office. Let's be frank about this. The only person who was less liked in this campaign than Hillary Clinton was Donald J. Trump, who won the election. They were the two least liked candidates, apparently, in US history. And yet, Hillary Clinton ended up becoming, in terms of votes cast, only the second most popular candidate in US history. Only one individual has achieved more votes than she did, and no white man in US history has ever received more votes than she did. The only candidate who ever received more votes than Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, 2008. So this idea that people stayed home because they didn't like her, there was something personal against her, again, we can dismiss. Winning the vote there by almost 3 million, best part of 2.1% of the popular vote. A lot of people, of course, have asked the unanswerable question, well, if Hillary lost this, who could have won it? Could Bernie Sanders have won it? Could Joe Biden have won this? We cannot, in any discernible way, answer this question. It's going to be one of these parlor games, I think, which we as academics, those of us who followed Neil Ferguson's early route down the idea of alternate histories and what-ifs, if you will no doubt play over and over and over again. I don't necessarily buy it, because I don't believe that it's Hillary Clinton necessarily as an individual who lost this. I want to talk a little bit about the reasons that she lost this, but I don't believe it ultimately had a great deal to do with her personal likability or, it must be said, her gender. I mentioned turnout to you a moment or two ago as a key determining factor here about how this election was won or lost. Questions about the Brexit spike, for example, that many people believe in the way Donald Trump talks about his huge surge in output. The suggestion that he's this remarkably popular president amongst Republican base. I still don't believe it's borne out when we look at the figures. Indeed, if we look at how it is that overall turnout, they speak for themselves. The lowest turnout since the year 2000, when 56.6% of the people chose to vote. If you look at the figures on the board there, this time around only 55% bothered to vote. That's a remarkably low turnout when you consider how much public knowledge there was of the event, how much was apparently riding upon this, and yet despite all that, some 45% of eligible voters decided that they really didn't want to bother voting at all. I think it's an incredible indictment of American democracy, but it also proves a point, which is that decisions are made by people who show up. And it would be fascinating to know just how many people who were out in the streets protesting in one march or another actually bothered to show up and vote. It's also clear, by the way, that there were people who voted on a state-by-state basis, for their local representatives who chose not to bother entering an option for the presidency. And indeed, in several states, the distinction between how much Hillary lost by and the numbers of people who voted in the election but chose not to make a decision about the presidency would have been very much, you know, determined. In other words, if they bothered to vote and they voted for her, she might well have won that state. I mentioned this idea that there's no evidence of a massive spike in support for the Republican Party. But the figures on the board there between Trump this time around and Mitt Romney 4 years ago, Trump winning 47.4%, Romney 47.2%. Democratic figures tell the whole story, in my opinion. You have a virtual stasis between the Republicans. The Democratic figures, look at the drop. Hillary, 47.7%. Obama, 51.1%. You see a decline in the Democratic base across the board, which is the key determining reason about why this election was lost. It's not that there was a huge upturn in support for the Republican Party. Despite the Republicans' appetite throughout the last 8 years to get rid of Barack Obama, despite the virulent hatred for Hillary Clinton amongst Republicans for the last 25 years, let's be honest about it, despite the stop Hillary rhetoric, there's no sense that the Republicans came out in vast numbers to vote against her or for Trump. Instead of which, bizarrely enough and tragically enough for Democrats, you see just a decline in Democratic support. The Democratic base stayed home for a variety of reasons. But it's also important to remember that in this binary system, there was a fly in the ointment for Hillary Clinton in many ways. Whenever you have a two-party system, as you have in the US, and a third party decides to basically get involved, that can only ever spell disaster for one side or the other. And we've seen examples of this throughout American history, which has tipped elections to the detriment of both the left and the right. It's often forgotten that one of the reasons Woodrow Wilson becomes president when he does is because Theodore Roosevelt decides that he wants another shot at the title. Having walked away from the presidency, he then decides he wants to put his hat back in the ring and challenge for the party leadership. And when he doesn't get it, he runs as a third-party bull moose candidate, splitting the vote on the right, leading to the election of Woodrow Wilson. Many of you know I do a lot of work on the Clinton presidency. But let's be honest about it. If Ross Perot doesn't run as an independent in 1992, winning 19% of the popular vote, exactly. Does H.W. Bush get a second term in office? Possible. Bill Clinton, don't forget, is elected with just 43% of the popular vote in 1992. Indeed, in 1996, when he's re-elected, he still doesn't win a plurality of the vote, getting only 49% of the vote. Why? Because of the split on the right with Perot running in both elections. And let's not forget in 2000, it's very, very easy in 2000 to focus upon hanging chads and irrelevance issues to do with that and look at the Supreme Court and talk about this as being some sort of a political stitch-up for Al Gore being won by George H.W. Bush's nominees to the Supreme Court, letting his son become president. But what ultimately costs Al Gore the presidency is Ralph Nader's third-party candidacy, winning hundreds of thousands, some 900,000 votes, if I remember correctly, in Florida, when all Al Gore needed from that was about 45, 500-odd. An absolute fraction of what would basically help them win in the presidency. So look at the figures here for third parties. They jumped by over 6 million since 4 years ago. The idea that Jill Stein's vote alone would have helped win Hillary Clinton the presidency. There's nothing I found, don't use the word pathetic, I think, to describe Ambassador Powell and her role at the Security Council, which I couldn't agree more with, quite frankly. But so too was there something woefully pathetic about Jill Stein going around in the aftermath of the election trying to get a recount in places like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, these key swing states that Donald Trump won and Hillary Clinton lost by that much. And she was so eager to get Hillary Clinton some votes, quite frankly, she should have basically put a mask on the wall some weeks beforehand and basically said, I can't win this. But Hillary can sure as hell lose this. Stein, Johnson, together basically in many ways helped cost Hillary Clinton the presidency.